Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Fate's Wide Wheel. We're here this week to discuss Miss Deep South, and we are joined by two very special guests. Dennis, do you want to handle those introductions?
Yes, I would. They are Megan Schemmel and Kelly Yocono, and what you are stars, co-host of a new podcast called The Courtesy Flush.
Courtesy Flush.
Courtesy Flush.
Courtesy Flush is,
it's a hodgepodge of things.
It
really
is. It's an oversharing of humanness, of trying to pay it forward with some, a lot of improvised, moments. Actually, it's all improvised.
Yeah.
And one of our concepts that we like to get into is, like, princess problems and what if Disney actually gave them real, like, problems.
Like, human problems, as opposed to, like, these, like, princesses that don't do anything. They're perfect in every way.
Yeah. So, like, an example, we have, like, a Snow White, what if she had gas, you know? It's those sort of scenarios that are very human and relatable and just silly. But,
You're about five episodes in? Five or six.
Or you release every Tuesday. They're usually about 20 minutes, 15 minutes or less, and it's just a bunch of fun.
Much less verbose than ours.
I mean, we could go on and on. We just figured, short and strong and sweet.
Right.
Sure.
It's just how I like my coffee.
Exactly.
What? Okay.
What? It's true.
We've made jokes about how bad just like my coffee jokes are.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, that's very true. Because they're horribly misogynistic most of the time.
Yes,
but other than that,
it was a previous episode where Sam had leaped into a woman, where that was the issue.
Yeah,
strong and black.
Yeah,
like that line from Airplane.
You know, speaking of Sam leaping into a woman, that is Miss Deep South, and this episode is directed by Christopher T. Welch, who would direct a few episodes, four episodes total. This is actually our last one from him. He had directed before this one of our favorites, I guess, if you would, the most cinematic episodes of the series in Goodnight, Dear Heart, just because it was kind of inventive and a little dangerous in some ways, if you will. But this will be his last episode. He'd also done Her Charm and Leaping In Without a Net. And then our writer is Tommy Thompson, who Dennis and I will not sing any songs.
Well, why not?
I mean, if you really want to bust out your Tim McGraw, go for it. But, he would write 13 episodes in total, and this is actually his third. He wrote Leaping In Without a Net and Leap of Faith before that. Our air date for this episode is going to be November the 2nd, 1990. Our leap date is June the 7th, 1958, and we are in Alabama, Montgomery. Or somewhere close by, anyway.
In the Deep South.
In the Deep South.
In the Deep South.
Yeah,
and,
we're going to talk about that a little bit later on.
And Sam has leapt into Darlene Monty.
She has.
Who is a contestant in the Miss Deep South Beauty Pageant. And she's also the winner, apparently, of Miss Sugar Bell. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently,
there we have
it. This episode, it's noted here... that at one point the working title of this episode was called Miss Dixie Peach.
Wow.
And I got changed to Miss Deep South somewhere along the way.
And the world is better for it.
Yes. But the TV Guide description, Sam, Scott Bakula, gets himself into a real beauty as Miss Sugarbell in a southern pageant. He must prevent a fellow contestant from making a tragic decision that will send her into oblivion.
Wow. There you have it. So Megan Kelly, what is your prior experience? Not Megan Kelly, because now everybody just thinks something completely different. Megan and Kelly, what are your experiences or non-experiences with Quantum Leap as a television show?
Well, it's funny that the initial episode that you shared with us was the Leap Home, I think was the name of the episode. And that is actually the one episode of Quantum Leap, or at least a a part of it that sticks in my mind watching it when it aired, like initially. And the vision that I have in my head is the scene where Sam, he's playing the acoustic guitar and he's playing John Lennon's Imagine for his sister, and his sister starts crying. And for some reason that was the first time I'd ever heard Imagine by John Lennon. So that's kind of, I thought it was interesting that it was that episode out of the plethora of episodes that was sent to us. So that's pretty much. And then he like watching episodes here and there, like nothing that I've ever watched twice.
Yeah. And my experience, this is Megan, growing up, you know, it's kind of one of those things I would see it here and there because when TV was live and I don't remember if it was on at 8 o'clock, I remember it being on at night. So I think maybe my dad had it on here and there. So I'd watch some of the episodes because I had such nostalgia rewatching it and hearing the music being played. And I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot about this show. And I always enjoyed it, but it wasn't, I didn't see it as frequently as I would like to. I always enjoyed the concept. So, and I always liked Scout Bakula. So
it's funny that you mentioned the music because as soon as the theme song started, I was like, oh, they're using the Doogie Howser like synth piano at the beginning.
Yes, written by Mike Post, who did Doogie Howser.
Yeah.
He did the original Law & Order theme.
I was going to say, it sounded like Hill Street Blues, too, or like Law & Order.
Yes, that, too. Mm-hmm. You play all those together, cousins of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that it's fascinating to me. I have a friend of mine who's a trombone player and has worked with some composers, and how so many composers, you know, they're always working. And so they might be doing, you know, a piece for a play or for a film or television, and it doesn't fit there. And then they just put it in their back pocket and they use it later. But it sounds, you know, similar enough. And everybody's got their own style. It's like, you know, you know John Williams music when you hear it, that sort of thing. And yeah, Mike Post is definitely no different. The episode starts off in a fashion similar enough to, you know, the leap ins that we get in other Quantum Leap episodes. But there's a nice little, in my opinion, there's a nice little twist, just because we only see him sort of from the shoulders up while he's on the bus. And so when he starts to walk off the bus, that's when we figure out that he's leapt into a woman again. There's not really, you know, much before that. He's wearing a poodle skirt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The camera shot up the entire body.
Now, just out of curiosity, so you've seen other episodes. Had either one of you seen What Price Gloria, where he leaps into the secretary, or Another Mother, where he leaps into the single mother?
It's been so long. I know I've seen him in some roles where he was a woman, but I couldn't be specific about it.
Yeah, me neither.
Okay. The reason why I ask is because a comment that was made, and I can't remember if this was on a message board eons ago or what, about how each of the episodes so far that have had him leaping into a woman deal with it in a little bit of a different way, which I think ends up kind of being the saving grace of this episode, maybe. I don't know. Okay. I haven't decided yet. Right. But anyway, so yeah, so he's a woman. He's Miss Sugarbell. Why can't I remember that? Anyway,
clearly established. I think it's his mom sending him off.
Yeah, yep. It looks her, that way. Her mom. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And we get the classic little boy and opening credits. And then when we come back. Sam is walking into the lobby, and pretty soon she gets. He meets Peg Myers, the pageant coordinator.
Yes. Oh, Peg. Peg is actually played by a familiar face, at least if you know, were raised on Matlock like I was. Nancy Stafford, and she played one of the lawyers on, I think actually, I don't think she played his daughter. Maybe she did play his daughter.
Maybe she's one of the lawyers on the show.
I can't remember now. Yeah. Anyway, and she's still working to this day, does a lot of television and you know, made for TV movies, etc. But she is syrupy sweet and has a nice, Southern Belle attitude about it all.
Yeah, and the first thing she notices is that Darlene, the woman that Sam has leaped into, walks like a man.
Imagine that.
Definitely a little rigid there.
Yeah. And so she goes on to teach him the step and glide.
Which made me think of the bend and snap. Like, I feel like don't know if you've watched Legally Blonde, but like, you know, like the glide. Yeah.
Totally.
And snap. Glide. Yeah. Anyway.
Dennis was doing it very nicely, too. The step and glide.
Step and glide.
Peg is the pageant coordinator, and the pageant is tomorrow night.
That's right. That's right. And
not
and
a lot of prep time.
No, not at all. And you can tell that Sam is already not enthused about this at all. Yeah. And we've gotten, even as recently as MIA, which is the second season finale, mm-hmm. at the beginning of that episode, Sam leaps in and thinks that he's a woman because he's actually a police officer dressed in women's clothing. And he's very upset at this. In fact, his line is, "Oh no, 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 not again, not a woman again." And so, while he's not that explicit about it, I think you can see that he's not too enthusiastic about it. But as the episode goes on, mm-hmm. it seems like more of that has to come from the fact that he hates the position that he's in.
Sure.
Even more than he hates that he's leapt into a woman, if that makes sense.
Especially because there seems to be a lot more writing on it. I mean, as it unfolds, that like it's not just that he's a woman; it's that there are stakes involved in this competition, in this, you know, I don't remember the pageant.
Miss
Darlene.
Oh, the name of the episode. Whoops.
Dang. Right. Well, yeah, and then when you throw Connie into the mix, I think that it definitely. And it's an interesting, you know, the episode is interesting in so much as he's almost got two missions. You know, he's got to help Connie, but he also has to make sure that Darlene still places.
He's got to become that cardiologist.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Which
win that scholarship.
It's fascinating to me because, you know, through no planning whatsoever, this episode ends up being kind of topical because the Miss America pageant. Which is no longer to be called a pageant. It's a competition now. There's actually a New York Times article that was just released because there have been a lot of changes. In fact, they're actually, if you go to their website now, they're calling it Miss America 2.0. Yeah, and it's really, really interesting. And it's also 50 years since the protest that took place in Atlantic City outside of the Miss America pageant at the time. There were, apparently they could not get a permit to have a fire, so they were not allowed to set their undergarments on fire, but there were, you know, a gathering of feminists that were protesting the pageant, and so they threw bras and underwear, etc., into a bunch of barrel drums, and then they were unable to have permits, so they couldn't actually set them on fire. But then they entered in, and they went into the pageant, and they hung a white banner that was, you know, that said something about, I can't remember now, and I don't want to mangle it, but it's a really fascinating article, and they've done away now with the swimsuit part of the competition. And it was just really kind of fascinating that this article came out on the 5th and this announcement came out shortly there, you know, before or right around that time. And now here we are doing this episode.
Yeah. You know what I remember about the Miss America pageant? Hosted by Bob.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank God.
That was a big, because when I was a kid, I loved The Price is Right.
Yeah.
And any chance to see Bob Barker in prime time?
Sure.
That's a good night.
That skinny stick mic.
The bar was low in the Freimeyer household.
Yes. So anyway, Sam fumbles through learning how to step and glide and step and glide. And Peg basically doesn't, I don't think she says the word, but essentially says, "Bless your heart."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have it till tomorrow night. And goes off, and then we are introduced to Connie.
Yeah, played by Heather McAdam, who, you know, was working quite a bit in like the 80s and 90s, got her start on a Kentucky Fried Chicken
Absolutely.
Commercial, which is oddly appropriate in a way for this episode. I don't know why. But she hasn't worked
I was looking
in about
at that too. I think, like,
so.
What was it, 97 was the last
IMDb,
project that she
so.
Did? Yeah.
Well, the last one, yeah.
Yeah, so. That's absolutely right.
Hopefully she found something else worthwhile.
Well, it seems like she's got a recent headshot on IMDb, so I just wonder if she's been doing more, like, you know, theater or what. I'm not, yeah, I really am. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, Touched by an Angel was the last episode. In fact, the title of that episode is worth mentioning for no other reason than that it's Angel of Death.
Wait, the name of the episode is Angel of Death?
Yeah, Touched by an Angel was Angel of Death that she was in. The interesting thing about her resume to me, though, is that she was on Sisters, which is I kind of hold up as being really one of the finer television shows of the 90s that falls Steel way Award. Under the radar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a good show.
Yeah, it was really, really good. But anyway, yeah, so we run into Connie.
She has Miss Corn Muffin.
Oh, God.
And so they have like the little, you know, cute little introduction to each other, and in this moment it almost comes out of left field where Connie launches into her pageant speech.
Yes.
But afterwards, yeah, because you never know when you might need it. She has a line: "You never know when you might need to be spontaneous."
Right. Right.
Yeah. Wink.
Yeah. If by spontaneous you mean heavily rehearsed, sure, why not?
Yeah.
And then it was shortly... Sorry. I was just going to say, and then shortly after that was when she runs into Clint. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Clint Beaumont. The smarmy photographer. Which when that introduction happened and she goes, "Oh, he has a really nice smile." I'm like, really? Really? He's pretty gross, dude.
Yeah.
Right?
The smarm.
It's, you know, it's one of those things. Dennis and I have talked about this before, especially in context of Quantum Leap, so I'm very interested in your take on it. But oftentimes we get characters that are presented and they're just so over the top in one direction or another. And Dennis, of course, chalks it up to the economy of storytelling. I chalk it up to laziness. He's so slimy and awful right from the get-go. Why would anyone want to spend any time with him? That was definitely my impression.
It's like the archetype of the guy that is the stereotype that is attractive enough and has enough power and allure that the unknown, naive person that wants to move forward sees that as a door that opens up and is too naive enough to see that he's just a wolf.
Right.
But yeah, he's just a wolf.
Which, and especially with his interactions with Connie and, you know, what we find out later about Peg, you do know enough about the world, like just in general as human beings, that there are situations like that and there are people like that that prey on, you know, people and just to get whatever it is that they want. And but he's just so terrible.
He has that line. He says, "Careful what you wish for, you just might get it." But in a threat, like, it was just something that he said that I'm like, ooh, I don't know. Okay, that's going to reel it in. But, yikes. It's a little threatening, Clint.
I want to go back to the moment when Connie was still doing her pageant speech to Sam's character. Because I screamed at the TV when he stole her lines and did her speech. I was like, you effing bitch, oh my gosh, you did the backstabbing thing. And she's like, I'm surprised Connie was like, she did react in the way that was like, I thought you have to look out for the nice ones. And they were nice in the beginning and totally stole that line from her mouth. I was like, ooh, you got to watch that one, Sam.
But then, like, he also, like, did it verbatim. And I was like, wow, great memory. Like, I couldn't remember that whole thing.
Well, it's funny that you say that because one of the things that is introduced about his character towards the beginning of season two is that he has a photographic memory. So it's not too much of a stretch for him to have been able to do that. But, yeah, it is such a shitty thing for him to do.
I don't know. To me, it's like, it is a shitty thing for him to do, but also, like, watching that moment. Like, I watched this episode twice this past week, like, once just casually with my wife, Betsy, and then, you know, again, to, like, take notes on it this morning. I get physically embarrassed for Sam because he knows he's doing a terrible thing as he's doing it, but he's on the spot.
Yeah.
He's in a rock and a hard place. So I saw his process. It wasn't malicious, but I'm thinking from Connie's perspective in that moment, you know, we're not internalizing or knowing Sam's plight. So for her, I was thinking from her perspective going, oh, but yeah, absolutely. His face, he's awkward about it. He doesn't want to deal with that, but he doesn't know what to say, it seems.
One of the things, too, that's really interesting to me about Sam throughout this episode is previous to this, there have been quite a few episodes where Sam really just slides right into whoever it is that he's leapt into in a very sort of confident manner, and he's able to attack the situations. And here, he's so out of his element. And I think it is a really interesting commentary about the fact that, you know, he's a woman, and especially compared to another mother, because he is certainly out of his element at the beginning of that episode, but really after about 5 minutes, he's doing a pretty decent job of, you know, being in those shoes. And, you know, I think in What Price Gloria, he, rather than kind of getting into those shoes, he's just kind of himself and it works. But here he's so out of his element. And it's interesting to me to see that as compared to, you know, he leaps into a soldier in Vietnam and he's never been a soldier in his life, but by the end of the episode, he acquits himself pretty well. And here, that's not really the case at all.
Yeah, exactly. But then, not only are we introduced to Clint in the scene, we are introduced to the mean girl of the episode.
Oh, God.
It just so happens to be, we don't learn her name now, but later on we find out that she is Miss Confederacy.
Oh, right. That's awesome.
That's right.
This episode, before we connected with you two and Dennis and I were just kind of sitting here talking, this episode, there's so much wrong with this episode. And there's so many things that I feel like, I can't remember, what was the word I used earlier? Do you remember, Dennis? Like,
problematic?
Yeah, no, that's, my brain is like mush right now. Yeah, there's so many problematic things about this episode, and some of them are problematic in such a way that they knew that they were problematic, and that was kind of what they were trying to address with the episode. And then I feel like there are other things that are problematic that they were not aware of at all at the time. Like, they just did not have the awareness to understand. Like, Al, for instance, is so problematic in this episode.
Oh my God, yes.
Voyeuristic, creepy man.
Oh, seriously.
Yeah. I'm just going to ride this elevator down and look up skirts.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, well, there's kind of, well, I'm going to go ogle her before I go, yeah.
Oh, well, Al.
One of the things I was even saying to Dennis earlier is that Al is no better than Clint. In some ways, he's worse.
Yes.
Because it's like, they don't know that he's there.
Right.
Whereas with Clint, at least, you know, he's a slime ball, sure, but he's a slime ball in person. So, right. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, it's just, well, so.
He's just watching, but at least.
Yeah. So speaking of that, we get to the next scene where everybody's doing their intro meeting, and Peg, the pageant coordinator, she's making some comment like, you all bring your talents and gifts, and that's when Al pops in and Sam's like, yeah, like,
right, yeah, yeah, yeah. And
at least I'm grateful. They could have been a lot worse with that line. They could have been a lot worse of a joke.
Yeah, it's at this point too where you get the idea that Sam, and it's interesting because I think that he would find it demeaning even if he was like one of the male judges. But he is finding it demeaning in this case because he's actually the one that is being demeaned and objectified. And you could tell through this conversation with Al that that's part of his problem with this whole leap. That it's not just that he's a woman, but it's like he's a woman in a beauty pageant.
Yeah.
He's not happy about this whole thing. I mean, later on when he goes into the interview section, he's like,
yeah.
He's like, what is, you know, what does the way I look have to do with anything?
For sure, yeah. But also, I feel like that's, you know, that's kind of a naive trap that Sam falls into. It's like, yes, he is going through this, and yes, this is a beauty pageant, but on any given day, women are objectified for their looks, and, you know, as Betsy said, get over it.
Well, and the very first pageant was literally, the competition was literally a swimsuit competition. Yeah. That was it.
Like in the 1920s, yeah.
It was strictly how you looked.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I understand where you're coming from, Dennis, too, with some of that stuff. But I got to be honest that I think that when it comes to Sam being upset and finding this demeaning and the objectification, like, it's clear that he thinks that when he's not in a beauty pageant. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, at what price Gloria? It's clear there. And so I think for him, it's just that it's under a microscope in this situation.
Oh, absolutely.
That it's not a case of, which this is no better, but it's not a case of, you know, a woman walking down the street and getting a catcall from somebody. This is a case of literally her entire worth is being based on whether or not she can win this competition.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. It's so, it's interesting. It's not a good episode. It's not good. But it tries.
Sure.
And there are some hits. Mostly misses. Anyway.
Sure. So we get to the moment where Sam gets caught talking to himself, and so Peg calls him out and invites him to stand up and say what being named the Miss Deep South would mean to him. And then we get to the moment that we previously touched on earlier where he inadvertently, not really having any other choice in the moment, he ends up stealing Connie's speech, and we see Connie's crestfallen, heartbroken look at this, and Sam like immediately realizes that he's kind of a shitheel for doing this.
Yeah, but you know the interesting thing is that Connie's very graceful about it all. Like she ends up, you know, forgiving him when they get, because they're sharing a room together, and
sure,
they go up and they're getting into the room, and she ends up, you know, forgiving him pretty quickly.
Well, it's nice that he came out and actually apologized for the moment. It wasn't like, hey, I stole this and that's the game.
Absolutely.
Girly.
Right.
It was like, I'm so sorry. I was put on the spot and I just stole exactly what you said. And I don't remember what else he said, but it was nice that she was willing to take that and empathize and be like, you're right. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
We're roomies. Yay.
Right. And then she's excited about the TV.
Right.
Yeah. So we get Leave It to Beaver, which is the second time we've seen Sam try on TV on the show.
And Leave It to Beaver's on, yeah. And the second time it's been an anachronism because the episode that is on the show and on the TV doesn't air until like October of that year.
Oh, that's funny.
I thought about that. I mean, it's like when you're doing a TV show like this, like how strict do you want to stick to that kind of stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I totally get that. And at that time, it had to be a little bit more difficult. I would imagine, like, in this day and age, it's so easy to find that information and know exactly when something aired, etc. But, you know, almost 30 years ago, it's, even in a studio, you were going to get a mislabeled tape, or you were just going to get whatever was given to you, you know, it's like, we need a clip from Leave It to Beaver. Okay, great, I'll try and find something. As opposed to today, I would imagine searching for a clip from Leave It to Beaver would be like, well, when does the episode take place? Okay, great, I got you. So it's like, I think it's also kind of indicative of just when it was shot and the difficulty of doing that. Yeah.
For sure.
Well, and the fact they were only a few months off versus like, you know, 10 years to be like, wait a minute, the show wasn't even born yet.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. And we also get some background information about Connie, you know, being the farm girl and poor. And it's very reminiscent, honestly, of what we got from Edie in One Strobe Over the Line. You know, the poor farm girl who's hoping to break out with, you know, this and be a model or be in pictures.
I want something more to life than kids and catalogs.
Yeah.
But I think she drops out, like, Connie's mom is 36 years old, has 8 kids, the youngest is in diapers, and the most exciting thing is the Sears of Roebuck catalog. And as Betsy and I were watching it this morning, she was like, Jesus Christ. Because Betsy is 36. She was like, if I had been born 50 years earlier, my life would have
way
been
different.
Very different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. This episode is 60 years in the past. God, almost exactly 60 years in the past. But it still doesn't, I don't know, in my opinion, it doesn't acquit itself well in that context.
I don't know. But anyway, so then Connie asks Sam to unzipper, and this is where we get like the first of many creepy moments of the town.
What was that?
What ladies, what do you all think about
Kelly? Would you like to share about the unzipping moment?
Well, from Al here in my notes that I have, Al equals growth. Like, because he's just, like, looking at her. That's kind of all I had. But, I mean, I wasn't expecting that. I mean, you know, you know, again, my context for the show, you know, was very limited. So, you know, kind of seeing that, it's like, dude, I have a feeling that this is what we're working against in this episode. But, okay.
I appreciated Sam's attempts to keep him at bay.
Yeah.
Since we already saw that he can be kind of creepy in the elevator. Or was that... Was that before this? That's after? So this is the first time. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was nice that he was unzipping Connie and then he shooed him into the bathroom so he wasn't watching her undress completely. So I like Sam's efforts. It was nice for him to, because he knows Al. Al's a creeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are moments I've brought up in previous episodes, like, you know, because I started watching this episode when I was a kid, but there are moments that Al does throughout the series. Like, if I were just, like, flipping channels now and I came across some of these moments, I'd be like, no, not watching the show.
Yeah, well, because the thing is, in this episode, it's kind of being done for, not kind of, I mean, it's basically comic relief. And I feel like you couldn't do that for comic relief. At least, certainly not in the same way today.
Yeah. But anyway. So they get into the bathroom and then we find out Sam's mission for the episode is that in the next, sometime before the pageant starts, Connie she's going to drop out. She's going to disappear. She's not going to participate. And she's never going to be seen, never going to be seen again.
Yeah, which is interesting to say the least. I don't know. I feel like it's, I don't know, because it's like, she's never seen again. It's like, does she die? Does she run away? Does she, you know, do we get any kind of sense of closure on what could happen to her and why not? And I don't know. It's just like, she just disappears and then she's gone forever. And that's it. Like, there's no other information that we've got at this point. And Al wants to stick around to creep on Connie some more. And, you know, Sam luckily shoos him away so that he can go get Ziggy into overdrive to figure out what's going on.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we go to commercial break and then we come back and it's, I just called this the parasol rehearsal.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Sam has a hair extension.
He does.
Yes, he does.
He sure does. A little
Which is
tail.
An odd thing, because, you know, you like, they'll do Sam's hair up when he leaps into a woman. But, like, this is the first time, like, they've added an accessory on there.
What's interesting, I read that as oh, we know Darlene has bigger hair or has bigger hair than Sam does, and since she's competing in a beauty pageant, she has a hair extension. So that was something that didn't, like, you know, didn't seem weird to me. It took me a second to kind of register, like, oh, I wonder if that's what they're going for.
Well, and in those moments with the parasols, that's a very standard look, and a lot of women out there don't want to do their hair multiple times, so they plug that in. They hairpiece it in. So if the hair is all up and that's just a little accessory, boom, and it's one competition, that's one way to just, you know, pin it on.
Yeah.
If it works right, yeah.
Well, that makes sense, too, in the pageant environment, having to go through, like, the quick changes and everything, you know, that it would require something for that sake. I totally get that.
Yeah. So Sam, he steps up, and they're doing their introductions, like, you know, saying who they are, what winning the pageant will mean to them, and he cannot get his parasol to close.
Yeah. Parasol problems. And, of course, as soon as he tells Peg that's what's going on, he successfully closes it.
Yeah.
The timing. How did you ever get hair?
Oh, yeah, that was... Was that Miss Mason Dixon? Oh, no, that was...
Miss Confederacy.
That was Miss Confederacy.
Miss
Confederacy. How did you ever get hair?
Oh, Miss Confederacy. So many thoughts went through my head when, you know, that title came up. And especially having lived in the South for a while. And
sure.
It's so... I mean, in 1958, of course, but it's
for
like...
Sure. Like, even in 1990, we didn't have the conversations about, like, the Confederacy and pride over the Confederacy and what the Confederate flag. Like, I don't even feel like that conversation really started until the late 90s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, things like that.
I would say that I think the conversation had started, I just think a lot of people weren't listening.
Fair point.
Yeah.
I mean, but like the mainstream content
right.
of like you know, like the Confederate flag or talking about like, you know, pride in the Confederacy, whatever that means, like that more mainstream people were like being aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, even now in 2018, it shocks some of my people in my hometown.
Yeah.
Where's your hometown?
My hometown is in southern Illinois, which I say, unfortunately, like they are in the heart of White County.
Mm-hmm.
And they might keep it that way, yes. And then unfortunately, they have let their true colors show a little bit more since the last presidential election, unfortunately. So it's, yeah, kind of a situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like one of the thoughts that I had too is the whole idea of the lost cause is what it really brought to mind for me, because here it is, she's being celebrated with this title and now she's in this, you know, pageant to, you know, win Miss Deep South. That's the other thing too, it's not just like Miss South and Miss Southern Belle, it's like Miss Deep South, you know, that conjures up all of these sort of images and feelings, which I think, you know, play into the fact that we're going to get some stock footage that's used later.
Yes.
And you just kind of have to shake your head and be like, well, that wouldn't be the case in 1958 Alabama. And the fact that, you know, yeah, that they would want to give her this title and celebrate that and that lost cause mentality and that myth that sort of built around it, it just feels so sad, honestly.
Yeah. So anyway, so Sam... parasol bit. Well, they ran out of time. Now it's time for the pre-pageant interviews. All the girls disperse. Al appears. We have the, you know, the hologram moment of the episode.
We have the slapstick moment with the dress and sitting down in a chair.
I think you better sit down, Sam.
I think you better set up, Sam.
Yeah.
That was such a weird moment because, like, it was an obvious setup for a joke that just fell flat. Or at least it did for me. Yeah.
I was looking down, so when I heard it, I was like, what's his deal? And then I looked up and watched it again. I was like, oh, the hoop skirt moment. Oh, every lady's had that problem. She had to work around. He got to lift that up. I mean, bless his heart.
Bless your heart.
Yeah. So then Clint shows up, or Connie says that Clint has said, like, there's some Hollywood scouts. They're scouting for the next picture. He wants to take some photos because he thinks that she has a real shot. Sam gives a little bit of effort to try to talk her out of it in the moment. And that's when they have this conversation. And this is where we find out kind of like the double mission of the sleep. It's not just saving Connie, but he has to make sure that Connie has to come in, or Darlene has to come in at least third, because she uses the scholarship to go to college and she becomes one of the top women cardiologists in the country and saves a lot of lives as a result of that.
Yeah. So I want to go back real quick because I do think it's worth just talking about for a second, especially because I would like to hear what Megan and Kelly have to say about it, is that Al, in the hologram moment, is standing there and the women are passing through him. And when Miss Confederacy passes through him, she...
Ooh.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
She reacts.
I was going to steal a line from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She gets a happy. And it's
Thank you for that.
What the hell do we think of that?
It's a little weird.
It was another gross moment, you know, because he's, you know, a hologram and obviously can't touch people and people can't touch him. That it was like, yeah, it was.
But then it made me question how much of an effect he does have. If she could actually feel it or some sort of a shimmer of whatever the form of the happy is.
Sure.
You know, it's just like, well, how made me question the world a little bit in terms of his effect.
That's true. Because, yeah, if you take away Sam, she's looking at Darlene. So it's like, wait, is there something else going on here?
Or was it just coincidence she turned around?
It's just like, just coincidentally, as she walks through Al, her and another contestant, they turn and they're looking back to laugh at Darlene.
And that was where I was like, is it just a coincidence? Which it totally could work that too.
Yeah.
They're looking through Al, but obviously they don't realize that.
But then Al has that fantastic line of like, even as a hologram, I still got it. And
yes.
Right.
And he does in a previous episode, which I think it leaves it even more up in the air, is he does say that children, animals, and this is the line, blondes with low IQs.
Oh, no.
And well, she can usually, like, see blonde? Or hear him. So.
I thought that was his wish.
Well, I'm not saying we should take it literally, but I mean, just think in the context of the scene, you do have to sort of say, huh.
I think the biggest question was because the look on her face didn't fully fit what's behind her. You know, I was like, oh, yeah. She could turn around at that moment and be a total coincidence. But she had that happy shimmer that wasn't like mocking. It was just like, ha ha ha.
Right.
Like, what are you ha ha haing about if you weren't affected? So I'm on the fence with that one.
Yeah. No, I agree. So am I. All right. So back to Clint and Connie.
So Connie's going to go off and take some photos with Clint. Then we get to the hotel room. And then we get to another weird joke that I just don't get, where Connie comes over to Sam and says, "Will you tie me up?" And Sam misunderstands that. And I feel like Tommy Thompson has written some great episodes of the series. This was not one of them.
No.
Just because of like moments like that. Like, where, like, I can't imagine any other episode where Sam would have that misunderstanding of tie me up means something.
Right.
Yeah, it just seemed like a cheap joke.
Absolutely.
Or like an easy.
Well, you know, that's a really great point, because a lot of this episode ends up feeling that way, especially the situations that Sam gets put in and Scott Bakula, the actor. It's like, let's put him in a bathing suit. Let's let's make him Carmen Miranda. Like, a lot of the situations in this episode don't make any sense other than
the visual gag.
Yeah, let's make a gag out of this.
Well, and that's the other question. You know, with it being 2018 and recognizing that the show was made in the 80s, it's that the fact that that is a punchline. A man dressing up as a woman is a punchline, and it's a sight gag. And in this, you know, day and age of, you know, transgender exception and transgender rights and being more conscious of those kinds of choices in TV shows, it is a fine line, because it's like, well, it was the 80s, like, those conversations weren't happening back then, but it is something that, you know, triggers in my brain of like, oh gosh, it's a joke that a man is dressing as a woman.
Is this 1990? Is this
1990?
Yeah, 1990.
Oh, it's 1990.
Close enough, though. Yeah, still.
Right.
It's still 28 years ago.
Yeah. Right. And that's an excellent, excellent point, because I think one of the things that the show is exploring, and we always try to put the show in the context of when it aired, of today, and when it was set. And I think looking at it when it aired, the concept of, you know, having him as a woman and encounter some of these issues, while not necessarily being revolutionary by any means, was definitely outside of the box when it came to your normal primetime television.
Absolutely.
And it allowed them to explore some stuff that seemed to be a little bit more, you know, liberal than what you might get on your regular, you know, evening programming on NBC. That said, you're right. In 2018, it plays very poorly, especially with the focus that I think has been put on gender diversity over the past couple of years in particular. And because it is a punchline, it is a gag. It is a man in woman's clothing as opposed to someone who's just wearing the clothing of their choice. And it's one of those episodes that unfortunately I feel like doesn't hold up very well for many reasons, but that's certainly one of them.
Sure.
Well, and I think that, like, to that...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Dennis. I was just going to say, and to kind of to that end, Sam, when you brought up that line about... during the interview, when Sam said something like, "Why do you need to know my measurements?" The absurdity of the question of verify if you're still a virgin and signing a chastity contract or something.
Gross.
It's like calling, you know, he was calling attention, whether it be because he was uncomfortable or, you know, the character of Sam was making a statement and bringing that to light of that's absurd and ridiculous for women to have to state those things for a competition. Like, it did like kind of stick to me, like, okay, I kind of read that as they're saying something about that, because back in 1990, if somebody watching it for the first time and hearing that, it might have gotten people to stop and think for a second. Oh yeah, why?
Absolutely.
I will talk about the swimsuit itself. I did notice that Sam was the only one that had the little skirt over, and I understand that's more a little hiding, not being a grape smuggler for everyone else there out there, I guess. Even so, as liberal as this show was in the day, it's very conservative.
Indeed.
Now,
although when he turned around, like there was some cuppage of the buttocks.
He's in good shape. He's in good shape.
Yeah,
he works out.
It's funny. One of the things that Dennis and I have even talked about is that he is probably in better shape now in the series than he was to begin with, and he was never in bad shape, but even like the tone on his arms, but in this case the legs, and yeah, his rear end, it's there's
his tuchus.
Yeah
But to speak to your point, like, so if you jump ahead to the swimsuit thing, uh-huh. Like, this is interesting to know, this is trivia that's in Matt Dale's trivia book that we reference a lot on the show, is one of the things that Tommy Thompson loved about writing this episode was putting Scott Bakula through the torture of having to dress up as a woman, having to dress up in the swimsuit. And so,
it's a personal joke.
Yeah, so I mean, so to touch back on your point, Kelly, about, like, you know, it being a really unfortunate, tasteless joke now, of like the joke of seeing a man dress up as a woman. Like, part of this episode was written just as a cruel joke on Scott Bakula.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, too, is it's like, how awful is that, that you have a writer who thinks that the way to have fun at an actor's expense is to, you know, put him in a woman's bathing suit.
For sure. And I did not picture this episode going this way, but let's just go ahead and tear it apart. Another thing in the book that I just read, like, before we started recording was that Tommy Thompson, like, when he wrote, the scene that we're going to get to here in a minute of Connie being to undressing for play, he did not realize how serious and messed up that scene was until they filmed it.
Yeah,
as he was writing it, he had no problem with it, and then they filmed it, and then he realized just how messed up that was.
I was uncomfortable watching it.
Oh God, yeah.
You know, like, it was very. The thing is that I think Heather McAdam does a really nice job in the scene. You know, Clint is so cardboard that it doesn't matter. You know, he's a cardboard cutout of just a sexual predator. So, you know, it's like, all I need to know about him is that, and that's all he is. Yeah. And that's fine, because it doesn't really matter that he's anything else. But, yeah, watching the scene was not easy.
It's the universal casting couch.
Yeah.
Welcome.
It's the Me Too movement. It's Harvey Weinstein.
You got to give me something to go somewhere, and this is how you make it, kid. I see potential, but you got to give me some cookies of some sort. And it's a quid pro quo, but really, I'm just going to use you and churn you out. Mm-hmm. Churn and spit you out.
And how crazy is it? Not crazy, it's the wrong word. Disturbing. How disturbing is it that watching this scene, you know, easily skeeved us all out, made us uncomfortable, that the reality of what so many people have faced is even more disturbing and disgusting than what
this was tame. Yeah. This was tame. It's so common.
I actually just saw a video. I think it was Asia Argento who just gave a speech at the Cannes Festival, the movie festival, and in essence called out Harvey Weinstein for raping her when she was 21 and making it in the, you know, trying to make it in the movie industry, as well as calling out a lot of people in that room.
Yeah.
Nice.
And saying, like, we know who you are now. And
you were accomplices.
Yeah.
You're culpable.
Exactly. So, I mean, and again, this going back to this episode was made in 1990. It is now 2018, and it is just now being brought to light, and people are being held accountable.
Yep.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I love old Hollywood and I love old movies, and reading you know, bios of certain actors, and there are you know, Spencer Tracy is probably one of my favorites, and he talks about and you know, to one of his biographers or something, very flippantly about an actress, and I know if I say the name I'm going to get it wrong, so I won't say it, but he talks about an actress and about how very flippantly, he's basically like, you know, everybody had her, but I had her first. So that was, you know.
Ew.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, and that there are other actors of that same era that you know would have to go to the casting couch in order to get anywhere, and that it wasn't as big of a secret as I think we make it out to be today. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like this is not a secret. It's just we're talking about it again. It's like the conversation was happening, just nobody was listening. And now
more caring.
Well, yeah. Right. And the thing, you know, the Asia Argento thing is so incredibly sad to me, because she ended up engaging in a relationship with Harvey Weinstein for a while after the first encounter. And for some people, seeing their reactions to that, they think that it negates the fact that their first sexual encounter was a rape. And it's like, no, that's not the case at all. Man. And again, having been in, you know, and it's not exclusive at all to, you know, the acting world or anything, but having seen people that have basically had to get subjected to, you know, whether or not it's sexual assault, certainly put themselves in situations that had to feel demeaning to them afterwards, because, you know, a director is a misogynistic prick or something like that is...
Well, and it's like, I feel like for myself too, like, you know, since a lot of this is coming to light fairly recently, I'm more aware of it now. So I feel like a lot of it that was already ingrained in society and something that was just socially just accepted that I just didn't even think about, like, you know, situations that would happen of like being catcalled or, you know, having, you know, somebody say something to me out of the blue, like, you know, for no reason, a stranger, not even thinking about these things, but then just being very hyper aware of those situations and being like, oh, wow, this happens a lot. And it was just accepted, even for, you know, from personally, too.
I think it's a matter of empowerment, and I think the change, the shift in time where women at least are getting support now and vocalizing, and I think they're seeing their speaking up is now being listened to, and there is a cause and effect, because even when you're like, well, that's just kind of how it is, yeah, you kind of roll your eyes, that guy's a creepo, let me just stay away from him, but that's the most you might get. You know, like, I just avoid that. But because no one ever actually felt empowered or listened to, and it's just, it's nice to have this new movement for people to be empowered and actually victims to be listened to, because half the time it's he said, she said. Mm-hmm. But then you also have the full spectrum where there's that whiplash backlash to all the men that are just afraid to just exist because they're afraid they're going to be somebody's next to me too. And my thing is like, you don't have to worry if you don't physically, sexually assault someone. Calm down. Calm down. Yes, there are people out there that will lie, but for the most part, that's not what's going on. I mean, there are exceptions to all these rules, and it's, you hopefully just listen to someone that is actually speaking from pain, and that you listen to them and support them and get them out of that situation. But
absolutely.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, now that we've mentioned Asia Argento, I just want to give a quick shout, because, you know, this is going to be a weird tangent, but one of her biggest supporters is the unfortunately recently deceased Anthony Bourdain. The two of them were a couple for a while. I don't know if they still were at the time of his suicide, but I think it was to be able to have. I don't know. I don't know what the hell I was going to try to say, but I couldn't help but not think of him because he was one of her biggest supporters and, you know, was on record as, you know, saying how incredibly strong and brave that he thought that she was for doing that. And not that, you know, she needed him to validate that in any way, or that, you know, any of the rest of us need that at all either, but
sure.
Just for the sake of being topical and also kind of taking a moment to honor a guy who was pretty fucking incredible and a lot of people could learn something from him.
Yeah. And just as a programming note, we're actually recording this just a few days after his death. This won't come out until probably like maybe early July, but yeah, this is just a few days afterwards. So
yeah.
But anyway, speaking of programming, get back on.
Good tangent, y'all. Good tangent.
That's what we do.
So we've covered a lot of ground. So the pictures have been taken. Even before then, Connie and Sam have a fight where Connie calls him out again for having stolen her speech at that intro meeting as Felix. Like, like, I have to watch out for you. Like, you're the nice one, but you're the worst one. And so she storms out. Sam chases after her. That's when she gets pulled in by Pei. When Sam gets pulled in by Pei to do the pre-pageant interview, and that's when we have that.
Purity contract.
The one guy's line, signing the thing that you are a virgin. Yeah. Betsy made the comment like he could not have said that line any creepier.
Yep. He's like, so, what are your measurements?
God. Ugh.
And it does make me wonder, up until how recently were those questions asked for, say, Miss America?
I knew you had
I'm sure the question about virginity probably dropped away, but even like for measurements, I could see that still being a thing up until a few years ago.
Absolutely.
Funny you say that. Just out of curiosity, I Googled just pageants today, and I found an application for Miss Bahamas, I think.
Oh, boy.
And I clicked on it to see what it involved, and all of the it asks for your measurements in that particular application still.
Well, but I also, as an actor as well, you're asked for your measurements at every audition, and if they supply you with costumes, maybe they supply them. I don't know
That's a good point.
So I don't know what the measurements are for, other than are these just restricting me from getting in? Like, are there dimensions that say, yes, you are approved to move to the next stage of consideration or not?
Or so. Is it like there's going to be a uniform where everyone will be wearing it and we need to know your measurements? That's a good point.
That's my silver lining. Who knows?
Well, I'm not making any judgments. I just found it interesting that Googling that and that application popped up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's such a weird world. And I mean, obviously, when you look at the way that it's sprung out, and especially with like the youth pageants that there are, and how incredibly creepy that gets, and the sexualization of young girls and all the way through up until Miss Teen to Miss America to, and it's I don't know. And the thing is, I can remember as a kid, it was a big deal, that once a year we watched the pageant and we all sat there and we were like, who do you think's going to win, and who do you like the most or whatever. Such a damn weird thing looking back on it. Like, call me crazy, and there are people out there that are fans and that do it and that are on the board, but I just can't for the life of me wrap my head around why the hell the world needs that.
I'll give you a little story, and it's not necessarily for the Miss America. Like, when I first moved here to Chicago, I had some friends, Southside people out in the suburbs, and every year they would have a Miss America pageant, the night of the pageant, and what we would do is we would bring all of our old prom dresses, wedding dresses, dresses you like have bought once and have never worn again. And we have a night where all the ladies come together and put on and all the different outfits and have changes and have food and drinks and have a, then we all vote and think of who might actually win. And then we have our own internal Miss America pageant. It was just fun and pageantry. It was about girls being together. It was never about, because it was just a bunch of women being silly and getting to wear their dresses, because my goodness, you spend that money, you better have a good time to use it again. And it was fun. And we'd be like, she walked so nicely. She did a really good job on that talent portion. It's funny how, as women, we would also critique the pageant talent and the women there. And it's just like, she answered that really badly. Very catty, but most of it wasn't catty. It was more like, I'm really digging this person. And it's funny. I don't know, just having experienced that like 3 or 4 different times where I was like, I would never have watched this in my adult life without having our own personal pageantry fun. But I get it to a degree. If it's entertainment. Sure. Now, if it's your life stake and your well-being, it better be a good scholarship to do all that. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. Quick question for you, kind of springing off of that and also going back to a moment earlier in the episode where Connie does get mad at Sam and says that thing about, it's always the nice ones. And not to get like too like, patronizing with this or whatever, but I think we've been sort of taught to believe that, relationships between women sometimes are contentious. and that there's not, you know, the ability to trust and that sort of stuff. So I'm just curious as to what your thoughts and feelings are in that particular moment in that scene and the way that Connie, you know, kind of thinks that, that Sam slash Darlene is trying to, you know, get in her way.
It's unfortunate at times where, especially in those situations where you are competing against other women. I wasn't surprised by her tone. Like, it's always the nice ones. Those are the ones that, you know, it's like keeping your enemies close sort of a thing where it's like, I'm going to keep an eye on those nice ones. You always got to watch out for them because they'll stab you in the back. The other ones, you know how to avoid.
Yeah.
But hopefully I think more women don't try and sabotage each other. I mean, I'm sure there's that, but it's, hopefully it's just a fun experience and people aren't just saying that to the TV and they're actually enjoying themselves. Because having those moments of the sisterliness and the bonding with women is such a great, innate, wonderful chemical thing. But it's true. Women can be bitches. And it's sometimes easier to be friends with men because you don't have to deal with the cattiness. But I also understand it's what do you want out of this and what are people willing to put themselves – it's being vulnerable too. So it's – if you're – not putting yourself out there and you're always playing defensive.
It kind of makes me think of a line from Mean Girls that it's the line like kind of toward the end of the movie where Tina Fey is addressing all of the burn book and the horrible things that were said about, you know, the girls in the class. And she goes, you've got to stop calling each other sluts and whores. It's just going to make it okay for guys to call you sluts and whores.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's, you know, for me, it was in that moment of, you know, trying to call attention to that of, as, you know, women, we've got to lift each other
up. Lift each other up. That's exactly what I was about to say. And it's so true. And it's just fundamental to happiness, man.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to me. And I mean, we've gone all over the place with this episode, and I promise we're going to get back to actual Quantum Leap here in a second. But it is fascinating to me that, hearing the way that you talk about, like, lifting one another up and that when you do hear that, you know, from women or directed at women, that it usually has such a positive result. And then the flip side of that with the way that you've got all of the, you know, men who are afraid of losing their masculinity out there and sort of the way that they decide to lift themselves up and how completely negative it usually is and how the way for them to lift themselves up is at the expense of putting others down. And I think that, and while I do think that unfortunately, no matter, you know, where you are, there are going to be people, whether it's, you know, in a division of sexes or races or whatever, you're going to have people that want to put someone else down in order to get ahead. That's, you know, there's unfortunately, that's kind of in human nature, but I think that it's much more prevalent in like these, you know, these men's groups or whatever. There's actually a science fiction author I was reading about. He's like a YA sci-fi author, and he got to start writing like The Christmas Box or some shit like that or whatever. But recently he came under fire for sexually harassing other authors and basically being Clint, going around to like young female authors at these conventions and you know, kind of being like, hey, you know, I can get you a publishing deal, just, you know, whatever. And he also has this retreat for men that he owns or sponsors or whatever, and it's just about men being able to get together and be men again. And it's like, when did you stop? Like, where? Like, what?
Right, right.
Well, it's just that thought of, and I feel like it's a vicious chain because of like, men growing up, you know, when they're boys, like you're taught, you know, don't cry, don't express emotion. Like, that's not a man. You gotta be a man, you know?
Yeah.
And like, that's another thing that needs to be addressed too, because like, that's not healthy. And it's what perpetuates this problem.
Well, I think when a lot of men get together, and you could also correct me, sometimes a lot of men have to get away from, go to a place that they're not told what to do or nagged or have the approval to do whatever they want and drink the beers and do the things. And I don't know if that's a relationship thing with their other person, whether or not male or female. You know, sometimes you just want to get away and be one of the boys and not worry about things and just lay loose and do what you do. I get that camaraderie sort of a thing.
But unpacking that, like even just that initial thought of,
right.
The definition of what it means.
I don't know. I've been think about it a lot, especially the last few months with, you know, everything going on with like the Me Too movement and toxic masculinity, and like thinking about like ingrained behavior and beliefs that I have, and just like unpacking that, like, where did I learn that? Like, I obviously learned it. Like, I, you know, I have these thoughts, you know, I like, even like, you know, to what you just said, Kelly, about like you don't cry, you don't show emotion, or things like that. Betsy and I were together for 5 years before she saw me cry, and it was in a show, in a performance, things like that. It's just unpacking where we get those beliefs.
Redefining what is a man, and allowing people to show vulnerability and emotion, and that is manly, that is strong.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely. There's this is another wild tangent, but there's a trilogy of books written by Pat Barker, the Regeneration Trilogy, and you know, she's a female author, and the main character is a gay male, and it takes place during World War I. So it's, you know, obviously much more taboo for that. And I ended up actually writing a paper on this when I was in college, and about the way that I think the vision of masculinity in these books, it was so fascinating to me, and how, you know, Billy Pryor, who's the character in the books, he often thinks, and again, this is like pre-John Wayne, but it was just the parallel that I drew when I was writing, but he obviously thinks that he has to be that kind of man, that kind of guy. And then as, you know, you delve further into his character and who he is as a human being, you realize that, you know, that there shouldn't be any sort of set definition of masculinity. That, like with everything, it's much more fluid, that there's a spectrum, and that it's, you know, acceptance is the most important thing. I can remember as a kid, I loved makeup. I loved painting my nails. I loved getting into my mom's makeup. And I remember how I was told that that was wrong. And so I stopped doing it. And it's funny because I was listening to somebody talk just a couple of weeks ago about how he wears nail polish, and like, he loves wearing nail polish, and that people look at him and think that that means that he's not a man, that he's not tough, that he's not, you know, all this sort of stuff. And yet that's not true at all. He's actually a very tough guy. It's a guy who like blew his knee out and, you know, acted like nothing happened and, you know, finished the project that he was working on with a torn ACL. Right. And so it's like, and so it's just, it is strange the way that these constructs have kind of, I think, prohibited people from maybe expressing themselves and finding the acceptance and being able to offer the acceptance when it, you know, should be so readily available.
Yeah. But I was just saying about that this morning, because Betsy, she recently painted her fingernails like a bright red, and our son, who's 15 months old, is very fascinated with her nails now.
Totally.
And so I mean, I was just like thinking ahead, like thinking about, you know, like 3 or 4 years down the road, what if he wants to paint his fingernails one day? And it's like, I want to let him do it.
Yeah.
But it's not like me not wanting to do that. It's like, probably we'll have to have the conversation with him that if you paint your fingernails when you go to school, people are unfortunately going to say something. It's like having that conversation, but not having the conversation that is quote unquote wrong.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like wanting to protect him as a father.
Yes. Yeah.
From other people's reactions.
From other people's reactions to it. Yeah. Right.
Well, I think it's fascinating because Sam Beckett wears makeup in this episode.
Yes, he does.
And yet it makes him no less of a man, if you will.
In the industry,
we
call
that a segue. Especially when he gets to confront Clint. You know,
yeah.
In a very
so
physical
we get to
the manner.
Pull side, it's so, well, no, before we get to the pull side, we get to Sam coming back from the interview.
Oh, and Connie's in the shower. Yeah.
And Connie's in the shower. And, you know, like I jotted down here, it's like the last time he saw Connie, she was going off to get photos taken.
Mm-hmm.
What did Sam think he was going to walk into? Because he planned on nonchalant, hey, I lost you down, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think he's hoping that she didn't do it, maybe?
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
That was kind of my take, is that, yeah, he was hoping that she listened to him at the end of the day. And didn't.
Sure, yeah. But then, yeah, he comes in the shower and she is, you know, curled in the shower with the hot water running over her. And, so basically, yeah, she, in the next scene, she explains that everything that happened, they do clarify that nothing physical happened beyond the photos, not that Clint did not try.
Yeah, because I think that's one of Sam's fears. It's actually one of the moments of the episode that I think works really well, because Sam's playing it with some levity and trying to be kind of softer towards her, and, you know, even makes the joke about you're going to shrivel up in there, and then finds her in this way, and then things, you know, kind of turn and do get more serious. And I think Sam is very concerned that she was assaulted. But then she, you know, says no, but like you say, not that he didn't try.
I say it's been over a decade since I watched this episode.
Yeah.
And for a moment, I was afraid that that's where it had gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it had gone even further. Mm-hmm.
Did you guys notice in the scene where he was trying to entice her to do what she needed to do, he never actually used the words. I don't know if this is the purpose in the writing, so it didn't come from the man. Like, he's like, what does he say? I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I think that you can go to the top. I really do, but you got to, you know, give me something in order to get there. And she's the one. She's like, what? He's like, you. He's like, now you know what sells in Hollywood today. Sex appeal. And that he's still innuendoing what she needs to do. She's the one that literally went, you want me to take my clothes off, don't you?
He never said that.
Yeah.
I found it really intriguing that, one, she was quite aware as to the situation, and two, she's the one that literally said the words, and he was all innuendo. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was interesting.
I mean, I guess, and this might be getting too deep into his character because there's not a lot there, but maybe that's one of the way that Clint justifies what he does is by trying to manipulate them into making it their idea so that he doesn't have to feel like the rat bastard who tells them you have to take your clothes off in order to get somewhere.
Or that he could actually say, hey, I never told her to take her clothes off.
Right. She said it.
She said it.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny. I was watching this with my husband. And he's like, that is the dollar store Matthew McConaughey from. He's like, all right. Like, you know, oh, yeah, the dollar store Matthew McConaughey. I was like, oh, my God, that's awesome.
What's the actor's name? If the actor who played Clint Beaumont is on Twitter, I'm
going to
tag him on our Twitter account
as the Dollar Store Matthew McConaughey. I mean, Dollar Store might be giving too much credit. Dime Store might be closer.
The Five and Dime. Matthew McConaughey.
David Allen Brooks, by the way, is that actor's name. Wow.
Puts his... He puts his finger on her chin and just like, I want you to do whatever you want to do. Yeah, oh, I'm going to empower you, child, to do what you don't want to do. But
as she's starting to like take off her clothes, like how it's so gross how he's complimenting her the whole time. Of like, oh, you're so beautiful. Oh, you're...
Well, those pictures don't turn out so well. You know, and you have a girl crying, and she's supposed to be on a calendar looking all sexy.
Oh, no.
Not this unless Mother Russia. The tears are for joy. I got bread today.
Oh, that's awesome. We needed that.
Yeah, some lovely girl. So, we did miss... Skip over Sam dancing to Quanta Leguso.
Oh, God.
For the talent portion.
Which is fairly iconic because it's something that's featured in the opening credits. So it's one of those scenes that, like, even if you've not seen this episode, you've probably seen him in that outfit.
Rewatching the opening credits this morning with more critical eye, it's either shots of Sam as a woman, Sam kissing a woman, or Sam punching somebody.
Yes.
Yeah.
All to the dulcet tones of Mike Post theme song.
That's America.
Three selling points.
I couldn't tell, because I don't know the song well enough, for the song that he was singing, if Al was giving him the words on the beat or right before it for him to try and sing it, or was Sam singing it after? I couldn't tell.
It sounded to me, and I mean, I don't know for sure, but it did sound to me like Al was actually singing on the beat and Sam was trying to copy him, which made him late.
Just a little after.
Yeah. It's also interesting anytime we get to hear Dean Stockwell sing, because it's not something that he enjoys, but it's not necessarily something he'll ever be known for.
Yeah. He does a rap in an upcoming episode.
What?
That's true.
Does he wear that same jacket too? That silver jacket.
Actually, his outfit is much more fabulous in the episode where he raps.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was possible.
Stick around, you'll see.
Oh my.
Yeah.
We did, several weeks ago, we did actually an interview with Jean-Pierre Dorliac, who was the costume designer on Quantum.
Yes.
Nice.
So we were talking about all of the, all of the strange outfits that he put Al in. And it was so, because like, when I was a kid, I wanted nothing more than Al Calabici's entire wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more than that. And, so when we were interviewing him, I had all these questions like what was his thought process was, like the future, like blah, blah, blah. And he just like totally dismissed me. And he was just like, I was just trying to make him look as gaudy and awful as possible.
Yeah.
Crushed soul.
Yeah, I was like, all right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah, there's also the, doesn't Sam have a line when they're backstage before he starts singing about how humiliating it all is for him?
Probably been what?
How humiliating everything is for him. Like, yeah. Like, to have to go out there and do this. Yeah. And then he fails miserably. It's pretty bad. He is. It's true. It's also the first time we get to the site of the Jerry Lee Lewis poster, so it doesn't come out of nowhere later.
That will come back to play later in the episode. And so now we catch up.
Sam and Connie on the bed. And conversation. Yeah.
Pictures were taken. Nothing more beyond that.
And now we get into the bathing suits.
Yeah, Peg comes in. Okay, Connie, you're sick. You're going to stay out of the photo shoot for the bathing suits. But Sam, you're expected to be poolside in your bathing suit. And this is where we get, the sequence where we just talked about earlier. Sam is the only one who has a skirt.
Well, it would have just been improper if he had not.
Like I said,
you know, one of the other things too about this episode that almost kind of proves how thin it is, if you ask me, is that we get a very extended sequence of this photo shoot. Like, there, this could have been character development for someone. I mean, I don't know, that's half joking, but seriously, there's this extended photo shoot for the swimsuit. There's there's a lot of stuff that in this episode, all the going through all the pageantry and all these scenes and everything, that I think could have just been hinted at, and we could have gotten a little bit more meat to the episode. But
I also that speaks to it's the visual gag of seeing a man in a woman's swimsuit and just like putting him in all these different
positions. Well.
I also found it interesting, too, because it made me start to wonder how tall Scott Bakula is and how tall the actress who plays Darlene, like when we see her in the mirror, how tall she is.
Yeah.
Because he's taller than all the girls, but then I feel like there's that one scene, I feel like it's back when Darlene was comforting Connie after the whole ordeal, but in the mirror she's kind of like hunching over, like she is that tall but needed to kind of bend down to comfort her while they're looking in the mirror together. That's kind of arbitrary, but I found
we talked about that a lot. Like, that's a thing that they obviously gloss over for the show.
Sure.
More or less, when they look in the mirror, the mirror image looks about the same height as Scott Bakula. For the most part.
Yeah, and it's actually, that's a really good point, though, because we didn't bring it up, and I do think it's worth noting that the mirror work in the episode is pretty well done, and furthermore, that the woman who plays the mirror image has some really great opportunities to play off of, whatever it is that Scott Bakula as Sam is doing, whether he seems to be kind of disgusted with the situation or uncomfortable or whatever, and it actually works out, and to me is one of the more amusing aspects of an episode filled with attempts at being amusing. So,
so at the pool after the photo shoot montage, Sam more or less confronts Clint after Clint tries to pull him over to take pictures, and then it escalates to Sam grabbing the camera bag, pulling Peg over, and says, it's your responsibility to take care of the contestants. He's doing private photo shoots in his room. Check out the film.
Yeah.
And then immediately backfires when Peg says whoever's on the film is disqualified.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then they get the film developed shockingly quick.
Right. What's the name of is it Peg or what's the name of the lady that runs the contest?
Peg. Yeah, Peg.
Peg. I had one of those moments where I'm like, I don't believe you. Like, before you realize it, you're naked.
Yeah.
I was like,
I agree. It was so. It was so strange.
It was a little heightened. A little.
It was a little. Yeah. It was very. I'm gonna say a little. It was very melodramatic.
It was.
Yes, that's the word.
It was, and it unfortunately undercut what I think could have been an interesting scene.
A really strong moment,
yeah. And again, there's echoes here of what we saw in a prior episode just recently, One Strobe Over the Line, because there's a model, and her agent, who is a former model, she has struggled with some of the same issues that Edie, the younger model, has. And so it's like this echoing of, you know, these two that are separated by, you know, a generation, and have both been pageant contestants, and, you know, now of course Peg is running things or whatever and fell into the same trap. But yeah, it gets a little like, where are the violins, you know, bring in some,
and another weird thing about this episode I've forgotten is, like, I thought Peg had been victimized by a photographer like Clint, but it turns out she was victimized by Clint.
Yeah.
And the actor who plays Clint is not old enough for that.
I wondered.
Yeah.
Because that was 8 years ago? 14 years ago?
Yeah.
1946 was the year she was
12,
in the pageant.
Yeah, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I had to go back and, like, re-listen to the dialogue of that scene, and that doesn't track.
You know, the funny thing is he's actually a lot older than you think he is, because he's 71 years old now. So, yeah. So when he shot the episode, he would have been 43. So it, believe it or not, the age actually kind of works out.
Tracks.
Yeah.
I have a question. About Sam's traveling and his strength.
Yes.
And does he have the strength of the character or of himself? Because I don't think that Darlene could hold a man outside a window that well.
fantastic question. So they don't explain it well in this episode, but the physics of leaping is Sam is physically there.
Ah.
He is surrounded by the aura of the person that he has replaced.
Okay, great. Still, people would be like, wow, honey. Right. Why didn't you do weightlifting for your talent? I learned it from the 4-H club, you know, when he learned how to fight.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
What a line.
Actually, so I wouldn't be surprised.
So throwing out to you two, like, what did you think of the scene where Sam, other than, like, the disparity of strength between, like, him and Darlene, of him bursting in and basically beating Clint up and, like, threatening to kill him by throwing him out the window?
I'm trying to remember any thoughts about it other than the strength thing. I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
I was like, really? Interesting. But the scenario didn't seem...
It was nothing that, like stood
out of sorts.
Yeah.
Per the situation.
Although, I don't recall this,
I'm trying to remember it.
I don't recall if... Did Clint have a reaction when he was initially punched by Darlene of, like, what? Like, you punched me really hard. I was not expecting that strength from you.
I don't recall, like, anything beyond a split second.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that there seems to be maybe shock, but it honestly, it doesn't seem to be anything more than I'm shocked because I just got punched in the face.
That's fair. That's fair.
I was asking because the first episode that Sam leaped into a woman, there are a couple moments, and especially, like, the last sequence of that episode where he physically beats a man up, and the women that we had guests on that episode, they took issue with the fact that, well, that's great for Sam, but that woman's going to leap back in, and she is going to face the consequences of having...
Right.
Of having done something that if a woman did it, the man is going to come back and retaliate in a potentially very physically harmful way.
Mm-hmm.
Which, obviously, in, you know, again, the context of a television show being shot in 1990, that was never on anybody's mind, because as far as they were concerned, the world existed for those 48 minutes, and after that, everything was going to be just fine. Of course it was, because that's how TV works, and that's how the world works, right? Mm. But, again, like, yeah, in a modern context, it does make you wonder, you know, does Clint seek vengeance on Darlene after getting fired and, you know, getting punched in the face and held out a window, and... You know, does Sam, again, I don't think he's doing this consciously at all, but does he put Darlene in danger by taking this action.
Sure.
Well, and hopefully it's a situation where he doesn't retaliate because Clint is like, now everything is now out in the open and he can be, there are you know, people that have, multiple women that have been victimized by him to end his career. I would hope.
I get the feeling that he just moved on to the next thing because as much as he got fired from that, it's not a promoted thing. So he just went to the next gig. That's my thought.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's...
And did the same thing.
That's probably true, unfortunately. You're right, is that he was able to just kind of slide on to the next gig and he's not going to get to come back to Miss Deep South, but, you know.
Well, even like, if he gets beat up, like, he ends up getting fired from the pageant, but he has the really skeevy line, well, there's always next year.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not next year at this pageant, but it'll be
somewhere else.
Oh, yeah. That's unsettling.
But they expose the film anyway, and now sure. The pictures are ruined. Peg tells Connie she can be in the pageant after all.
Sure.
But now Sam is like, why the hell haven't I left? And that's when Al is like, you've got to ensure. Which, it's odd in a way, because you have to wonder, well, if she placed third and went on to become a doctor anyway, like, what has Sam done that would prevent that from happening?
Well, now right. She leaps back in and she's disoriented.
Sure.
She's lost a day.
Or one could also argue that because Sam has not acquitted himself well as a beauty pageant contestant, that there's this sort of, you know, preconceived notion that he's no good, so the judges are just going to kind of be like, not this person again. Yeah. Whereas now he has to rise to the occasion and, you know.
But the upshot is, he doesn't leave because we get to see him.
That's right.
Do the people that Sam jumps into remember anything? Or is it...
It's
unclear.
It's hinted at. Unfortunately, it is left mostly unclear, but it is hinted that because of the way that when, like, Sam's brain gets Swiss cheese, so he doesn't remember everything when he leaps around. And part of the theory, and again, it is hinted at in a couple of episodes, is that what happens is that when he leaps out and the person leaps back in, they kind of get some of his memories, so they kind of know what's happening. At the same time, there's also the fan theory that they're being prepped on everything because they're in like a waiting room in New Mexico at Project Quantum Leap, and Al is interacting with them, and so they're actually talking to Al, and Al is kind of filling them in. And I think there's an episode at one point where like Al's like, yeah, this guy thinks he's been abducted by a UFO, or like there's different things where you get to hear a little bit about it, and then there are a couple of episodes where we actually see the person in the waiting room, but that's all later down the road.
There are, they start playing with some things in the last season, and there are actually some episodes in the last season where they show Al in the future talking to the person in the waiting room, like, counseling them through what they need.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's one episode, future spoiler for any listeners who don't want to hear, there is a future episode where Sam leaps into Dr. Ruth.
Oh, God.
Dr. Wolf, yes.
And at the end of the episode, Sam isn't leaping because Al is undergoing counseling by Dr. Ruth in the future. And we actually see those scenes of Dr. Ruth counseling Al, and Sam doesn't leap because Al needs to have one more counseling session with Dr. Ruth to work out his, basically his problem with objectifying women.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. How about that? After five seasons, it gets addressed.
Hey, at least it does.
That's true.
That was something else my husband said. He called Al the human illegal camera. I was like, you're golden, honey.
Yeah.
And apparently, and here's the other, like, he said something happened in South Korea recently where there was some protests about some cameras in private spaces where they were hidden in women's bathrooms. And a woman did the same to a man, and she got in big trouble. And it's sort of like the government had to get involved, but once the tables were turned, it wasn't okay because it was for women who were objectified. But once a woman did it to men, the government got involved. This is modern day. This is today. This is what he said. Google it. I'm spreading lies otherwise.
Snopes it.
I totally believe it. It's the world.
Anyway, so we get to the beauty pageant, and we get like the little, not very much of a montage at all.
Pretty short and sweet at this point.
Freaking out right before him doing Quantum Leap so. Basically, like, he's going to come in fourth if nothing changes, and so they decide they got to They got to change things up. They are very conveniently standing in front of the Jerry Lee Lewis poster. Sam, we were talking about this off mic before we started recording. What's wrong with this Jerry Lee Lewis poster of him performing here at this time?
Well, I'm not saying that there wasn't a concert scheduled for then. It is entirely possible, but it definitely never took place. And part of the reason why is because at this particular point in time, Jerry Lee Lewis was actually in England. And anyone who knows anything about Jerry Lee Lewis and his history knows that when he was in England, it came out that he had married his 13-year-old cousin. And so when he came back to the United States, he was met with quite a chilly reception. And people kind of were no longer so much fans.
Their balls are not on fire anymore.
Their balls are no longer flaming. Yeah. The other thing that's kind of worth noting here, we talked about this on previous episodes, is that Quantum Leap does have a tendency to kind of follow along with whatever sort of was popular at the time. Certain episodes, you know, might echo a popular film or something like that. Great Balls of Fire, which is the bio of Jerry Lee Lewis, the film with Dennis Quaid and Winona Ryder, had actually just been in theaters not too long before this. So it does kind of make one wonder if they decided to include this number, because at the time that film had been out, it didn't do very well. But that's beside the point, you know, if it was in their consciousness and they're sort of like, you know, what would be fun? To have Scott Bakula do this, because he can actually play the piano. And,
yeah, he's a musical theater guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So anyway, he does. He sings Great Balls of Fire. We get treated to...
This is where we get the stock footage.
Yeah.
Did you notice...
Oh, the audience stock footage.
The stock footage. I know it's the Deep South and it is a pageant, but that was the only black person I saw was in the stock footage.
Yep.
Everyone else was white. Lily white.
Yes, indeed.
I was going to ask, what platform did you two watch this episode on?
Hulu. I did.
I also watched it on Hulu.
Okay. Because I think on Hulu it's standard definition still. I watch it on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And so it's high definition. And the thing is, Quantum Leap uses a lot of stock footage, and watching it now on Blu-ray high definition, the stock footage really jumps out at you, because there's a very clear difference in picture quality.
Oh, yeah.
Where if, like, if you were watching it in 1990, probably was not.
As much of it,
the definition.
And the next episode, which takes place during the LA Watts riots, they use a lot of stock footage to the episode, so it's,
Yeah, you'd almost think, though, that in that episode they didn't care, because even the footage would have been 25 years old and they knew it wasn't going to match. But, one of the things that's interesting about this to note is that as a result of this stock footage specifically, Jean-Pierre Dorliac decided not to submit the episode for consideration for the Emmys, because he felt like this sort of just ruined the illusion, because these characters, these in the stock footage, are wearing clothes from like the 70s. And the rest of it was all period appropriate, and these dresses that he had designed, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's interesting that he was like, no, I refuse to submit it. Doesn't stay true to my work because of the stock footage.
Yeah. So we get the performance of the song.
Yep.
And then we get to the finale, the announcements. What do we call it?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's the graduation day.
What?
I said it's graduation day. I don't know.
So third place is announced, and Darlene is not announced in third place. And this is where it caught me. This is the scholarship that she used to go to college.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Scholarship for third place is $500.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think how much money that would be today.
We could Google it.
But that jumped out.
Like, I don't know. Was that a lot or was that a little? I'm assuming that's a lot.
I mean, yeah.
And college was like a 1500.
Right?
Just a little girl. So, yeah, while you're Googling that sentence.
Why not?
Second place is announced even before
which
then.
I thought was really entertaining, because it was the Miss the jerk girl.
Yeah. Confederacy
was like,
girl.
Yeah, the confederacy that, like, she smiled, but then there was, like, a moment that, like, oh, second. Oh, okay.
She was smiling because she was like, oh, good for you. Oh, it's me.
Oh, it's me. Yeah.
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 I enjoyed that moment.
And then Al says that Connie's going to go on to have a film. I think she goes home. She opens a beauty salon. She has a fulfilling life. And then first place is announced, and it's Darlene.
It is indeed. There she is.
Made me wonder how that affected the other first and second contestants originally.
Ooh.
They didn't mention that ripple effect.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because when we were talking about Leap Home Part 1, Al, as he's giving Sam his mission about having to win the basketball game, is saying, like, you know, if they don't win the basketball game, these guys won't go on to be doctors, or because they won't get their scholarships, etc. And Dennis brings up the great point as we're talking about the episode. He's like, what about the other team? What about Bentleyville?
Right.
Like, these guys lose the game now. What happens to those guys? So it's more important that these guys end up, you know, so.
Well, it's funny, like, after the game, Al says that as a result of the victory being different, one cheerleader
Lisa doesn't marry no-nos.
Marry a certain basketball player. And he's like, yeah, Lisa doesn't marry no-nos, doesn't marry you either, but at least he doesn't marry him and have a couple of bulldogs.
Yeah, so he's erased two kids.
People have been wiped out of the timeline.
Oh my God.
Al just waves it off as a joke.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, I don't want to take too much time to quibble about that, because I have to bring up what is probably one of the worst moments in Quantum Leap up to this point, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, here we go.
Which is
Sam crying, wishing that his sister could see him. It felt so wrong
on so many levels.
At the end, I was wondering that name that he said.
It's really glossed over. He just says that he wishes Katie could see him.
Oh, yeah.
And Katie
cried?
Is.
Yeah, there was like a tear.
A tear?
Yeah.
What was their relationship? Why would he want her to see him in that position?
See, even beyond that, like, why would he be, like, it just feels so weird that Sam would think that Katie would be happy and proud of this moment and would want that for her and would want, like, it just doesn't feel right at all. It's such a bad line. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it was odd. But I think for me, it's because I didn't know who Katie was either. So I'm like,
sure.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think I assumed, because I had heard your episode before of the coming home one. So I was like, oh, yeah, the sister.
Oh.
Okay, but I forgot about it. Because I was like, that's weird. I forgot about it already.
See, it just struck me as a cute little moment.
Well, good. That's what it was supposed to be.
I think, like, you had to put something there, because if you didn't give emotional stakes for Sam in that moment, it's just Sam walking down the aisle going, all right, I won a beauty contest. I got life slightly better for the person I leaped into. Why haven't I leaped? Mm-hmm. Giving him stakes and being proud of it and wish that his sibling could see him, it gives him something more in that moment.
I get that.
Yeah.
Dramatically and motivation-wise, yeah.
Or maybe in that moment, he's thinking, okay, he got first place, meaning that he got more money for Darlene. Maybe that means more patients Darlene is going to save. Maybe she graduates college a little bit sooner and is able to become, you know what I mean? Like, maybe having that extra boost helped her career a little bit more.
Because his sister was in an abusive relationship. Is that the whole thing? What was?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like empowering women, and I wish she had seen us and been in this moment to celebrate it. So I can get that.
So to throw you a curveball, when Betsy watched the episode, she thought that Sam said, I wish that his dad could see this moment.
Interesting.
That's very liberal.
Something tells me John Beckett would not.
John Beckett would have a lot of...
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. I appreciate you guys' point of view on it, but I still loathe it. I just think it's is tone deaf to me, because it doesn't play true to Sam, and it doesn't play true to the character that we meet as Katie either, in my opinion.
I gotcha. As creepy as Al is in this episode, he does have a nice moment when he does react to Sam's line. He's like, oh, Sam. It's just like, seriously? It's a cute little moment. There are some episodes where Al's really great, good guy, really noble, and then you have episodes like this. And I've gotten to the point, I've stopped blaming Al the character, and I blame the writer of that particular episode.
Yeah.
Because the thing is,
because a lot of times they shift his character around to fit what they need for that particular episode,
And sometimes it's really inconsistent.
Yeah. I mean, the next episode's a perfect example of that.
God, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And it's so straight. How in the world, within the span of a few episodes, can we have Sam creeping on teenage cheerleaders? And that feeling, not that it's okay, but feeling better than his behavior in this episode. You know what I mean? Like, if you put those two episodes side by side, I can kind of be like, all right, Al, I'll write you a pass for the cheerleader thing, but this one is raw. You know, it's like, it's that, it's so bad.
Yeah.
So bad.
But anyway, so Sam leaps.
He does, he leaps.
He's with a woman.
He's laying, got his shirt open.
Yeah, and very quickly they are approached by three men, and it's apparent that something is about to go down.
Yeah, and there's a fight.
Is afoot.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that that they're approached by three black men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we get.
Yep.
That's it.
Yeah. To be continued.
Indeed. I always enjoyed that of Quantum Leap, and for me, Gem and the Holograms did this too.
Truly Outrageous?
Yeah. Where they leave like a little bit to leave you wondering what's going to happen in the next episode to keep you watching. But at least in Gem and the Holograms, they have this huge problem at the end of an episode, but then they solve it in like 10 seconds at the start of the next episode and start a completely different story. Whereas Quantum Leap is not that way.
Not sure you watched Gem and the Holograms, but that's how it went.
Oh, I did. I had a Gem doll.
Yes, with the glowing ears. Did she have the earrings that glowed?
Showtime synergy.
I'm telling you, when I was a kid, I wanted to paint my nails. I watched Wonder Woman and Gem.
Yes.
Love it.
You know? And then they steered me the wrong way, and now I eat red meat, and... No, I don't know.
Now I eat red meat.
Ain't nothing wrong with me.
Well, okay. So I think everyone can pretty much guess my feelings on this episode. But ladies first, Megan, Kelly, give us your opinion overall on Miss Deep South.
Stop calling them Megan Kelly.
it was very topical. What I appreciated was how relevant a lot of the stuff is.
Yeah.
Yeah, this episode definitely made me Google, you know, what is happening today with, you know, the whole Miss America pageant and the messaging that's been changed along with that, for sure.
All the Me Too stuff Yeah, it was relevant. Was it a great episode?
Lovely.
What'd you think about it?
Yeah.
More explicitly, I knew that there
were going to be, what I remembered of it, I knew that there were going to be problematic elements in the episode. Just like the whole plot of, like, you know, the pictures being taken and how that was handled and the way Al behaved with the contestants. Speaking to your point earlier, Kelly, I really didn't being in the moment of like how, like, in the age that we're now through a 2018 lens and talking about, you know, the humor of a man dressing up as a woman and being insensitive to transgender issues, that kind of, like, even though while I hope that I'm sensitive to that from day to day, having, you know, known this episode since I was a kid, that element kind of went over my head a little bit. And I think I kind of fell into the trap that, next week's episode, which we were planning to record that episode today, but the guest had a thing come up, so we're recording it later. Next week's episode is a very dark, topical episode, and so I was kind of expecting that to be the heavier episode of the two episodes that we recorded today.
Well, silly.
Yeah. And
I'm sure it'll be just as heavy. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
until we really start talking. How this episode falls on someone who is not familiar with the show at all and they're watching it through a 2018 lens.
I still want to know how they verified the standard declaration of purity contract. I mean, it makes me think of, you know, I know there's still those purity groups out there that you sign, and I'm like, that makes me think of, like, define what is purity and what is sex, because I know a lot of girls that accept the back door, they're still considering themselves virgins, and I'm like, well... wink, wink, backdoor, when they do sexual acts that are like, well, what is purity? What is the contract? And then how do you prove it? Because honestly, if it was the hymen back in the day, I'm sorry, you ride a horse or you wear a tampon, you've lost That's your purity. It. Sorry, we're all screwed.
Yeah.
Or not. But how do you prove that? I mean, really.
Yeah. Absolutely. It is. Yeah. How in the world are you going to possibly verify that? Why should you be verifying that? What is your definition?
There's a pageant doctor.
Oh,
no,
oh,
that's
God.
Never mind.
Bad thoughts.
I know, right? I did this interactive theater piece that was not always necessarily in the best of hands, if you ask me, with the people that were running it. But basically, the idea is that you went to high schools and you basically did these very frank shows about sex and sexual assault and rape. And sometimes it got to be just a little too... It's one thing to talk about those things in a frank manner. It's another thing to be kind of explicitly
graphic.
Gratuitous. Yeah, for you know, that sake. And there were a couple of times when I felt like we were crossing some lines, but whatever. And that one of the biggest issues that they were facing at that time is that there were a lot of girls apparently that thought that there was nothing wrong with the back door, if you will, and how that was completely okay, and how there are quite frankly a lot of health risks involved, and
yes.
You know, they're just willing to do it because it means that if they do that, that they're still pure, and you know, it's like, what's your definition? What's your knowledge? You know, education is much more important than saying don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
and also not being ashamed of things if you enjoy that sort of aspect. It's like, this is not something to be ashamed. This is your body. You have control over it. Whatever someone else says about it, it's not as important as what you feel about it. And that makes me think also about Connie's statement of like, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life scratching at the dirt and having 10 kids pulling at my skirt. That makes me think 10 kids, it's like oftentimes that's not a choice. Like having prophylactic or people that are Christian based and don't use contraceptives. And a lot of times the women in that situation don't get the choice and are left dealing with 10 kids. I mean, I am in the middle of 9 kids. That was my parents' choice. They are very happy, but it's unheard of these days. But back then, no, mm-hmm. no.
That's
expensive.
No,
time consuming.
Especially now, imagining somebody having 9 or 10 kids now, I can't
afford sanity. No, I mean, my parents are my heroes. I don't know how they did it, and bless them. I'm just, I'm the middle of 9. I'm number 5, and I could not imagine that ever.
No, me either. I mean, we're just about ready to have our first, and I'm just kind of like, that's enough. That's good, right? Like, I don't need more than that. anyway.
When you go from 2 to 3, that's where that shift is like,
I think that you guys have raised some really great points, and I'm so grateful that you joined us for the episode. I just for my final 2 cents, I think that the episode does end up feeling topical, unfortunately, and I think that the fact that we're still talking about issues of this nature 28 years after this episode was filmed and 60 years after it takes place is indicative of how much further we have to go. In fact, one of the protesters that was interviewed for the New York Times article on the Miss America pageant and the changes that were being made, I thought made such a brilliant point, because here's a woman who 50 years ago was protesting the pageant, and now these changes are being made. And she says, "What can I say?" said one of them, Robin Morgan, the author of more than 20 books of poetry and nonfiction, including the 1970 anthology Sisterhood is Powerful. After 50 years, this is a start. And I think that that's the thing that even I sometimes forget, is that, you know, progress is also very fluid. And just because you make progress at one point doesn't mean that you don't have a lot further to go. And so hopefully, as we continue to have these conversations, we can keep having those new beginnings that lead to other new beginnings that, you know, remind us that we're probably never going to get to the finish line, and that's okay. But as long as we keep moving forward, that's the most important thing.
Sure.
Yep.
Maybe not just start that conversation
Yes. All right. Well, Kelly and Megan, see, I switched it this time. Avoided the issue. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. For our listeners, where can they find you on the interwebs?
At courtesyflush.lol.
Lol.
Or on iTunes and any of the streaming channels for podcasts. So, and we're, if you want to email us for topics, if you like it, we're at please@courtesyflush.lol. And yeah.
That's the question I was going to ask you earlier. You said you improvise all of it.
Yeah.
Do you kind of like come up with like ideas for topics before you jump into an episode, or you just like show up and just hit record and see what happens?
Sometimes each of us comes with something in mind, and then otherwise it's just a fluid conversation, but we try to keep it focused so that we're not just jumping all around doing too long of a segment. But no, and then the improvised scenes for the Princess Problems, those are definitely all improvised, and we actually suss those up like a scene.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, I've been enjoying listening to your show, and thank you.
Yeah, I just got to listen for the first time today, so I'm looking forward to hearing more. And we'll certainly include stuff in the show notes. But yeah, thank you again. And I think it's time to leap out of here.
All
right,
sweet,
right on. Awesome.
So we will see you next week for Black on White on Fire.
Indeed, we're gonna have a special guest. My buddy Lamont will be joining us, so should be a good, interesting time. Another episode that is all too topical. But while not having any of the amusement of Miss Deep South, so be prepared. But thanks again, everybody. We're going to leap on out of here. Take care in the meantime.
See you next week.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. I want to stay.